Welcome to the Rethink Tax podcast. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Alexia and Margot Broglie, the co-founders of Your Juno. Margot and Alexia, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome. How are you both doing?
Thank you so much for having us. Yeah, it's such a pleasure to be in here with you.
Likewise, I'm very excited for the conversation that we're going to have. So thank you for having us.
Yeah, no problem. Well, maybe before we get into our conversation today about tax and gender, you can just share for those listening a little bit about Your Juno. So can you tell us, what is it and what are you trying to achieve?
Absolutely, yes. So Alexa and I are sisters, and we started Your Juno together about 8 months ago. And Juno is a financial education platform for women and non-binary people. So we are trying to bridge the gender wealth gap by providing high quality, unbiased, and engaging financial education to that group of people.
Amazing.
And we have got our app that is launching in about a month's time. And I think the best way to describe the app at the moment is a little bit like the Duolingo of money. So we're trying to treat learning about money and learning about finance in the same way that you would learn a new language. So it's bite-sized and it's led by incredible women in the field. And it covers pretty much all areas of personal finance that you can think of.
Amazing.
From investing to property.
Brilliant. Well, I love that. And I love that analogy. And it's so spot on, isn't it? Because actually, you know, I know I've sort of known you two for a while now, and we've been talking about how Juno has developed and why it's so important to teach people about becoming money confident and getting kind of a little bit more information about how does money work and how can you make money work for you. And actually, one of the things I've noticed is that there is a language to the world of finance. There are words and concepts that some people will struggle with, and if you're not brought up to kind of be taught those things at home, well, you're not getting the education in school. So you really need platforms like Juno to kind of help bridge the gap. So I love the ambition.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that I'm noticing for myself now. It's a world that I wasn't part of up until a few years ago. And now I hear myself talking, and I can hear all those same words, and I'm using them just like another language that I learned. So it's definitely something you acquire as a skill.
Yeah. And so your platform's obviously aimed, as you said, towards women and non-binary people. Tell me, why are you focused on the female audience? What is it about women that either puts them at a disadvantage or that you think makes them a special interest group for this kind of education?
I think this is a very complicated question to which we could answer with like a three-part essay. But overall, what we're trying to tackle is the gender wealth gap. That is our mission. And financial literacy is quite poor amongst both men and women, but women still, to this day, always in almost every country score significantly lower in any financial literacy exam than men. And I think there's two main factors that lead to that. First of all, there's an actual lack of knowledge when it comes to finances, but there's also a massive confidence gap. And what we're trying to tackle with Juno is really bringing them the confidence and the knowledge so that they can participate in the same wealth building opportunities that men do. For example, crypto or investing or property. Nowadays, not only are we still paid less, but we also invest a lot less. And both of those elements together really create a massive divide between men and women and creates a big gender wealth gap.
Yeah. No, I can totally recognize a lot of what you're saying, not just from my own personal experience, but from talking to friends and other women who I've met along the way that, yeah, there's, I don't know, is it nervousness or, as you said, lack of confidence and lack of education. So it's great what you guys are doing. Hopefully, if people haven't already heard of Juno, they'll come flocking to see your app when it gets released at the end of the month. So watch this space for those listening for more on that. But so today, girls, I know we talked about, well, discussing the topic of the pink tax. And obviously this is a podcast all about tax and tax and gender. So I wonder if you could just start by telling me a little bit about what you've seen and what you've discovered about the pink tax and What is the pink tax?
Yes, absolutely. So I think the pink tax is often defined as the fact that it costs more money to be a woman. And that's not necessarily because of what we're buying, but it's also because the brands and the product geared at women are more expensive. And I think the most well-known example of that is with toiletry. That example has been quite popular recently about razors, where there was literally the exact same razor. It is the same product, but one of them is in blue, one of them is in pretty pink, and the messaging is different, and the female branded razor costs 49% more than the men's razor. So it's a substantial difference. And if you think about how much that adds up to over a lifetime, it's absolutely gigantic as a difference.
Okay, so let me just break this down. So the pink tax, it's got the word tax in it, but it's not an actual tax that is being levied by any government. What it is it's almost the expression that's used to describe gender-based price discrimination. Is that fair?
That is correct. I think the tax where there really was a tax imposed by the government on being a woman or a person that is bleeding is up until a few months ago, sanitary items were still considered a luxury, which means that they were taxed at a much higher price than other more traditional sanitary items that or toiletry items. So in that sense, all those that were bleeding were actually paying a much higher cost for products that really are not a luxury at all. Anyone who has had a period knows that getting your tampons is not something that is bringing you exceptional amounts of joy or that is a treat for yourself.
Absolutely. So for people who may have sort of remembering some of these headlines, this is the news about the fact that there is a concept called the tampon tax. And actually, this is a global issue. In the UK, the tampon tax was kind of publicly scrapped by the government post-Brexit, saying, you know, now we are free of the rules to abide and align our VAT rules with the rest of Europe. The move was made in response to quite a lot of campaigning from interested groups that said, actually, it's not right that tampons and other sanitary towels would carry 20% VAT, which was traditionally used for, as you say, luxury items, and instead that should be scrapped. And the government responded and agreed and said, okay, we're going to get rid of VAT. So yeah, there's definitely this kind of, there's a couple of different concepts going on here. This is the idea of a cost to women and others that sort of identify as female from items that are focused and directed towards women that are costing more, and therefore this is the idea that the cost is equating to a tax on being female. And then there's these examples like the tampon tax, where there is, for a lot of women still around the world, still a concrete additional cost of actually buying items that are, you know, sort of gender specific.
Mm-hmm. I always think of the pink tax as the cost of being a woman. And I think is often talked about in the context that we have just mentioned here when it comes to razors or tampons. But one thing that is often overlooked is the other costs of being a woman. And we actually asked our community on Instagram what they perceived as a cost that they have. And something that came up a lot is the cost of safety and the cost of traveling home from a night out, for example, and not being able to go back home alone and having to take an Uber. And we did a little bit of digging into this. And there's a study in New York that found that women will spend on average $18,000 over 30 years on traveling expenses for safety reasons. And it's not as evident as a pink tax cost, but it definitely comes from the fact of feeling vulnerable when you're coming home because of your gender.
Yeah, and I think a lot of women can identify with those kinds of examples that you've raised. What are those costs that are incurred that perhaps men maybe don't have to think about or don't think about because of their circumstances? And how does that all add up over time and actually go to reduce financial equality between men and women because of the impact it has on their ability to put that money to other good use.
Mm-hmm. And I think another nuance that I'd like to bring to the idea of the pink tax is that women also aren't a homogenous group. Mm-hmm. And we can see that the pink tax is even more, even stronger for populations, certain subgroups of women. And so, for example, in the UK, even though black British women only make up 4% of the female UK population, they have to spend 6 times more than their white counterparts on hair care. Razors are expensive when they're targeted at women, but hair care is significantly more expensive when it's targeted at people of color. So the pink tax goes beyond just gender, I think.
Yeah, and this is so important because I think this is a lot about, you know, and I guess the question is why, right? Why? Why does a haircut cost more depending on your gender or your ethnicity? And I guess, you know, to the extent that there is, or a product costs more for your gender. And I guess for some people from a business perspective, they might say, well, if there's a significant additional cost in producing the item, then it might make sense for that to be passed on. But the razor example you gave is one I know people will be familiar with. Like, there is absolutely no difference in the item that you're buying. It just happens to be marketed for one gender over the other.
Absolutely. I think that it has a lot to do with, obviously, willingness to pay. And that can be also traced back to the expectation on women to look a certain way. And I think somebody, I saw that it was called the grooming gap.
Right.
So women are expected to spend, have proper nails, proper hair, have all sorts of different treatments, have their eyebrows perfect. And that also adds up a lot. And what we see is that women who don't conform to that are actually penalized by being paid less. Mm. So I think a recent study found that women spend on average £70,000 across their lifetime on their appearance.
Wow.
And when you think about what men have to do, they have to, sure, look presentable and look nice, but there's less products that are being sold to them with that kind of appeal.
Yeah. How many times has it happened to you that you've gone to work and you weren't wearing makeup and everyone was telling you just how tired you looked? I thought, none of the men in this room are wearing makeup. No one's telling them that they look tired.
Yeah, that's definitely happened to me on occasion, for sure. I can identify with that. I mean, this is a fascinating conversation because I think, and I'd love to know more about what you just mentioned there about this link between presentation and pay. And I think we'll all be familiar here with the idea and the problems with the gender pay gap. But I think, you know, if I look at how this links to the tax system, I think there's a couple of areas I'd call out. And I'd say, you know, one is the fact that actually as a group, women do generally occupy lower paid roles, and therefore, maybe they are more reliant. And I know there's been some work done by people like the Fawcett Society and the Women's Budget Group that show that women are more reliant on the benefit system and the social security that is offered in the United Kingdom, and actually aren't in positions where they're higher paid and therefore higher taxpayers. And I think as a result of that, they do have less disposable income, which then is compounded by the effect of the pink tax, which just makes life more costly for those women. And I suppose when you feed that through to some of the themes that you're exploring with the Juno community around, well, how do women start to reverse the trend from around gender wealth disparity? How do you think women can go around best educating themselves and then learning about what changes they can make on an individual level to kind of reverse that trend?
Yeah. I think, first of all, from what you just said, there is the gender pay gap, so we earn less, and then there's the cost, the pink tax, so we spend more on being a woman. And the third element that comes kind of into this is the gender investment gap and the fact that we don't participate in a lot of the wealth building opportunities. But I would like to preface this by saying it's not up to the individual to counter systemic change. And yes, whilst we can wait for systemic change, we need to take matters in our own hands and educate ourselves. But it really shouldn't be up to us to do this. And women are systemically being disadvantaged just because they are women. So before we go into what individuals can do, I think it's important to acknowledge that it shouldn't be our responsibility. And Margot and I, we really don't like all those sort of neo-feminist sayings that are like, oh, just, you know, be louder at the table and then suddenly you'll be heard. It shouldn't be on our shoulders to do this and change our behaviors in that way.
Yeah. So I totally agree. I mean, I think, you know, as you said, there is an element of like personal education in this discussion where, you know, it's good to know about the issues that you're kind of mentioning. And do, I guess the question in my mind is, do all women and men appreciate that this is what women are facing in terms of their lifetime costs and the implications for their own sort of financial well-being? I think, you know, to your point around, is there a role for government or others to step in and start helping shift that trend? I would tend to agree. I suppose one I guess reflection I have, and this is where I think action by government doesn't always equal benefits to women, is with the example of the tampon tax. So when the government announced the abolition of the tampon tax in the UK, it meant that all those products were reduced to 0% VAT rate. Yet I've yet to see a reduction of prices being passed on to the consumer. So whilst the policy from a tax perspective seemed to be responding to the request for greater equality, actually, I'm not sure that's turned into business actually passing on the cost savings to the end user. So we've achieved something in terms of the narrative around getting rid of the tampon tax, but have we actually achieved the end goal of making those products more accessible to women who maybe don't have as much money to spend on those things?
Yeah, I think you're pointing out something that's incredibly accurate. And the reality is that nowadays corporations have so much power in shaping the cultural zeitgeist and the norms. And I think us as consumers, we always say money is one of the most powerful ways to cast a vote for the world that you want to see. And as consumers, we can hold brands accountable. If all of us started boycotting tampons because they haven't reduced the price, they would very quickly start taking this seriously. So I think it's also realizing that us as an individual consumer has, if we come together, we have the power to create change if we've really become aware where we're spending our money, and that every dollar that we spend is also casting a vote.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's obviously highlighted something where maybe government policy hasn't necessarily had its intended outcome. But I do think there are other areas where actually government could take really constructive measures that would help women. And I know a lot of women's groups in the UK at the moment are very vocal about the fact that, you know, the planned stop to the increase in universal credit, which is due to come to the end of September, that is something that will disproportionately affect women who are often cases reliant on that universal credit to kind of make ends meet, both for themselves as individuals, but also their families. So that's an example where I can see that, you know, direct change in policy to the extent it was taken up by the government could have a material positive benefit for women who are recipients of universal credit.
Yeah. And then I think on the individual level, what we can do is making sure that we know how to navigate our current system as good as possible. And yes, the system might not be equal, but there's ways of making sure that you put yourself in the best possible position. And there's steps like maxing out your employer pension contributions, making sure that you are regularly investing, that you have an emergency fund, making that you at least attempt to negotiate a raise every year or every 2 years. There's these steps that we could take and that a lot of us don't, because we've never been taught to do it. It's not taught at school. It's not taught at university. Some people have rich parents and they have the privilege to be taught these types of personal financial steps. But many of us are just learning by doing.
Absolutely.
And I think that is one of the most powerful things that you can do as an individual, is taking your own financial education into your own hands and making sure that you take those steps that put you in the best possible position.
I totally agree, Alexia. And I think, you know, I love the concept that you're building with Juno, which is almost like peer-to-peer knowledge sharing, right? This is a community of women that are coming together, some of whom may have been in those positions, as you described, of benefiting from either family circumstances or schooling, which did give them some of those tools that others haven't had access to, and actually allowing them to cross-fertilize, in essence, that knowledge and build each other's confidence in a way that can then actually help women generally actually find some greater financial well-being and freedom, taking some of the steps you've just talked about.
Absolutely. And I think one of the shames when it comes to personal finance is that because we are left to just learning by doing, a lot of us lose the first 10 to 15 years of our career. And you go in your career, you're earning your first paycheck, and you're thinking that you can take those steps, such as investing and employee pension contribution. You think that you can take them in 5 or 10 years' time. And so often a lot of women at 30 years realize that there's so many steps that they could have taken 10 years ago and that they didn't. Mm. And the problem is that when it comes to money, time is your biggest asset. And so the earlier you start, the more this will compound. And we really should all be considering those steps as soon as we enter into a full-time role and we have an income.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I would say I was probably one of those women who, despite having a, you know, by comparison, particularly very well-paid job, actually didn't really know an awful lot about how to manage my money that I was being paid. So, you know, I am grateful to have found learning environments, including the one that you guys are creating, where actually I can supplement my knowledge, which was starting from a pretty low base, but actually try and make up for some of that time and actually now sort of pass it on to my younger sisters and other women I know who maybe have the advantage of those years that I didn't quite get to have. So I really applaud what you're doing in that sense. And I totally hear what you're saying, that, you know, bridging the financial education gap is a hard ask for any one individual or any one group. And actually, we do need something more structural. But in the meantime, I think what you guys are doing is great. For those that don't know Juno, please do go check them out, find out a little bit more. Alexia, Margot, perhaps the last question I have for you, you know, I guess the question would be, what would your advice have been to, I know you're not quite as old as me, but a younger version of yourself, trying to figure out where to start on your financial journey, what one thing would you say to that younger self about what to do and I guess where to become money confident?
Ooh, that's a hard one. I would say that the obvious response would be to say start investing. And I think everyone would say that, because the earlier you start, the bigger your returns. But I would say more of a mindset shift and really telling my younger self that finance is not a men's world. Investing is not as complicated as it's made out to be in movies. And if you just do a little bit of digging, you will actually understand what comes up and you will know how to take those steps. I think the financial industry is filled with jargon and it's really made out to be something that is impenetrable if you don't have the required knowledge. As soon as you scratch the surface, you realize it's really, I don't want to say it's all a hoax, but it's it's not as complicated as it's made out to be in the media or portrayed online. So back yourself and start learning, because you'll be surprised by how much you can actually do yourself as well.
Yeah, and I'd add on top of that is really starting to take action, even if it's just small steps. But I think so many of us get caught in a sort of inertia where we feel like we have to be experts to start. So we have to understand everything about investing to be able to start putting some money into the stock market. But if you just start with £10, £15, it's not an amount of money that would have a dramatic impact if you lost it. But just the fact of doing it will immediately get you into the momentum of feeling much more passionate about seeing your share portfolio increase from one day to the other. And I think it makes it much more accessible as well.
I love it. I think I'm going to wrap this up by kind of saying that I think the message here is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So, yes. You know, don't wait to be an absolute perfectionist before having a go. And maybe you'll find out that actually it's not as hard as you thought. It's not as scary as you thought, and you can do it. So I love that as a parting message. Well, Alexia and Margot, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. I guess for those listening, we'll be back soon with another episode of the Rethink Tax podcast. Thanks as always for listening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carla. It's been such a pleasure. We'll be right back.